Vladimir Putin has again reiterated his vow. He will take the Donbas area, either by negotiations or by military force. Now, that can't be a surprise to anybody, but what does seem to be a surprise to many in the West is that he can. And the longer we ignore these realities, these combat realities, which are now piling up every day, the more Ukrainians we're going to condemn to an unnecessary and painful death. And to try and talk about a lot of this and kind of figure out where we are, where the Europeans are, where the Ukrainians are, where the Americans are, we have back with us today Patrick Henningsen, host of Sunday Wire, geopolitical analyst and journalist, and at 21 Wire. Patrick, as always, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be with you, Daniel.
Well, let's just go. I mean, it's almost redundant here, but President Putin, on the eve of visit to India, reiterated to the Times of India, I think it was, that he just flat out said, yeah, we're going to take the Donbas militarily or otherwise here, and no one should be confused about this. Now, coming right after Steve Witkoff spent 5 hours with Putin and then left without any kind of declaration by either side, what do you make of this?
Well, it's interesting just reading the statements from Usakov and others on their reactions to this long conference. Apparently, it went late into the evening, but no formal conclusions. I think they're still in the kind of understanding phase. I think this whole process is really trying to give Trump's negotiations team, the current negotiation team, really a master course in geopolitics, history, and diplomacy. And they've got a lot of catching up to do. I think this is really positive. The positive part about this is it seems like from the Russian side and from the U.S. side, for that matter, that they've acknowledged the facts on the ground. They've acknowledged the battle realities on the ground. This is hugely positive. This is a giant step to understanding going forward. The fact that the U.S. government, the Trump administration, is acknowledging this is great. And the other fundamentals are well established, which is no NATO membership for Ukraine. This is hugely positive. And also the other parts I'm not so sure about, everything that was in this 28-point plan, including the Donbas specifically, that's what Putin's addressing there. Not a good deal for Russia. And talking about, having it a halfway house of 15% remaining territory or 20% remaining territory that Russia doesn't fully control, that's really just kind of, planting the seeds for potential future conflict. You're talking along with 600,000 Ukrainian standing army. I mean, this is totally unacceptable for the Russian Federation there. But what Putin's doing as well is just kind of sending a message to the Europeans, along with other statements that he's made, which I think are quite striking, but absolutely kind of dragging Europe into the reality zone on this, saying that, look, we're not looking for a war with Europe or NATO, but if they intend on starting one or launching preemptive strikes, as the Italian military official intimated, then Russia is certainly ready to respond. And he said that response will be swift. And he thinks that, well, it's not going to last very long. Let's just put it that way, is the messaging, the signaling from Moscow on that.
You know, it's interesting. So that's something that Putin said again just today. But that's just a reiteration, not just something they've been saying for a long time, but even about 10 days ago in uniform, Putin was very, very stark in what he said.
We have our own tasks, our own goals. The main one is the unconditional achievement of the objectives of the special military operation and the fulfillment of the tasks that our fatherland and the people of Russia set before us. The people of Russia are counting on us, counting on you, and expecting the result the country needs.
So he said, we'll take it all one way or the other. I mean, he's really never said anything besides that. But this is now becoming a little bit more common that he's making these comments in uniform in front of his military commanders. Is this just a coincidence, or do you think that there's a specific message being sent here?
I think Russia's, of course, very confident. They're in a very strong position militarily, certainly not going to be giving any concessions away, like I think, maybe the Trump administration initially was thinking about getting. That's just, it's just not going to happen. This is a situation where, Russia would be forced to give up whatever it gained, and Ukraine would recover whatever it lost, including the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. This is a huge set piece in all this because, you know, first of all, that to be under international control, that's a massive red line. Ukraine having the option, or NATO, to sort of retake it, or there's some international peacekeeping force there. And not only that, the enriched uranium issue. That's a major geopolitical, national security, existential issue for the Russian Federation. It's not going to be allowed to be in Ukraine's hands one way or the other. It's going to be under Russian control. It will have to be, based on what's transpired. All of these different points. And then Russia's also having to price in the erraticism, potentially, of the Trump administration, because look at the record of the last 10 months, and Biden's record as well. Biden reneged on promises all the way back to the phone call in December of 2021 about not putting offensive missiles in Ukraine. And of course, the Biden administration completely did a U-turn on that one. And that kind of set the tone for Russia-U.S. relations in terms of trust. But Russia's always been there with this open door policy. But I think it's a very skeptical open door now, still keeping lines of great communication open with Washington, which is interesting because this is also, Russia's clever here. They know there's a fissure between Washington and Europe, a few different fissures. And they're cleverly, I think, using this because they can draw a distinction between Europe and Washington on this, and they're making the most out of this opportunity. And
you know, let me ask you a question on that. You mentioned that a second ago about this current diplomatic team you mentioned here, which was Witkoff and Jared Kushner, and it wasn't Rubio, but when you even when you take all those together and you look at who's on this side, whether it's Dmitryov, whether it's Sergey Lavrov, etc., certainly Putin. I mean, these guys have been around a long time, and they're literally the deans of diplomacy in the world right now. I don't know that anybody's been in place as long as these guys have. And then you see here, Jared Kushner, I mean, I don't know what his credentials are for diplomacy. And you have Witkoff, who's a businessman, but has been jet-setting around here for a while. But and even Rubio himself, who wasn't involved in this one, but apparently he's going to have to be at some point if this is going to come to a mat. But all he's been is a politician in the United States and has no training or experience in the diplomatic world. What is that? What can we expect, or what can we result from that when you're talking about an end-of-war negotiations when one side is extremely experienced diplomatically and has the military advantage over the side on the United States?
I think that with Kushner and Witkoff, the first thing you need to recognize is that these are two people that Donald Trump can trust, I guess. You know, so that's a bit, Trump puts a high currency on that because he has been screwed over many times by his various envoys. I won't mention any names, but it's a long list and a distinguished list. So he's got, it's the trust factor. These are people extremely close to him that he can trust. He puts a premium on that over, I would say, experience or skills. That's good politically for Trump in order to try to push the ball down the field on this. But the downside is that his team doesn't have the skills to basically close this deal. This is a complicated deal. And while you might want to shut Europe out, that's, you're talking about NATO, the rest of NATO, that's Europe. And then you're talking about the government in Ukraine. You know, you can shut them out of this process, but that can also come back to bite you. See, what's missing here, Daniel, is to glue something like this together so that it actually works, you would need to, and if I was, you know, if it was my project or my deal, I would handpick the most skilled and most experienced and affable and great diplomats, historians, and emissaries, and like John Mearsheimer and a whole host of others, maybe yourself included, but I would send them to all the four corners of Europe. I would send them into the Democratic Party. I would send them to the rhinos. You need to get buy-in. And this takes charm. It takes skill. It takes knowledge. This is a huge historical major event on this planet. You know, to bring this to a close, this is a big black mark, by the way, on European history. And I think it'll be looked back on as a huge black mark on NATO and the United States as well. So to fix this, You need to deploy people and get everyone to sort of accept a fait accompli or to get buy-in. And that's not easy. And so Trump's skipping all that, and he's hoping that just by going to the power end of the negotiations, which is Moscow is more powerful than Europe as an individual country, than any single EU country. He's writing off Brussels, which it's not a bad thing to do in this case, because Brussels is also in big trouble in terms of corruption scandals, credibility, and a democratic crisis in Europe, losing Hungary, Slovakia, and some of the Central European countries, rigging the elections in Romania. So Europe's in a state right now. So, but he's to glue it all together, you still need to get these people to buy in to make this happen. So Russia's going to play this game. They're quite happy to play the long game with Trump, and knowing that it's going to take a long time to glue this thing together. And meanwhile, Russia has objectives that it's going to achieve on the ground. I think Washington accepts that might be the case. Trump said so in his statements. We should make a deal now rather than later, because they're going to lose all this territory and men. Trump said it. Even Trump gets it. So if Trump gets those basics here, Russia knows that Washington knows this reality. But Washington can't do anything about the situation beyond trying to negotiate with Russia. They still can't guarantee they're going to get the British, the Germans, and the other Europeans that are pushing for war. They're talking about conscription now more than ever. We're gonna be ready to confront Russia for a major war in 2027. Other statement by German ministers. You know, so that's still going on. So you can't.
Well, and that's actually what I wanted to say. I mean, you say that Putin understands the fissures between the United States and Europe. Yes. And he understands where Trump puts his value, I guess, with trust, somebody that he knows, but somebody that doesn't have the diplomatic acumen or historical knowledge, which is vital in this case, as you point out here. But then on the other side, you do see that the European side is, since they're left out of this, because now on the Trump problem from him is he's not engaging them. He's not very much. They're kind of left on their own, and they're saying, all right, well, let's go down our own path. And it turns out that President Putin also addressed that the other day. Tory says, you know, it looks like when this whole 28-point peace plan came out from the United States, that Europe set about immediately to try to sabotage it.
Even when they...
That's the one, Gary. Yeah, play that one.
Even when...
Well, we seem to be having some technical difficulties with that. Let's try one more time.
Even when they are trying, allegedly, to introduce some changes, some adjustments to the President Trump's proposal. All these changes have only one goal in mind. They are aimed at blocking and putting to a halt this peace process. They are trying to make demands that are unacceptable for Russia, and they understand this, and then later they would try to blame Russia, accuse Russia of stopping this peace process. This is their objectives. And we can clearly see that. That's why, well, if they want to go back to the reality, considering the reality on the ground, then they are welcome.
So what does that tell you about where the Russians are in terms of the fissure between the United States and Europe?
Yeah, they're well aware of this, and I think they're using it. I think they're playing this. They've priced in all. You know, they've priced in Trump's flip flopping, and dilly dallying, and media antics and showboating. They priced all that in. They've priced in all of this sort of Western media cycle that's necessary to feed our domestic political, whatever games are going on in the U.S. or Europe. Russia's priced all that in. I think it's brilliant, because before they used to basically take the West for its word when it looked like there was a serious breakthrough, and they would be prepared, you know, to pause. In some cases, they've made sacrifices in the past, but Russia's not doing that anymore. They're not playing. They're not naive enough to think or to trust the West. Now it's trust and verify on the Moscow side when they're looking at the West. So that's interesting. And the other thing is Zelensky got stood up in Dublin. I believe that Steve Witkoff was meant to meet. The little man went over there, and he did his grandstanding in the Irish Parliament and did all that. And then there was supposed to be a sideline meeting while Witkoff was on the way home from Moscow. And it did, I think, so Zelensky got stood up. It's pretty clear. That was, I think, a major development here. Now, Rubio not attending the meeting in Brussels, that can be interpreted a couple of different ways, but that's not necessarily business as usual, not to mention the U.S. is now spread thin trying to start a new war in Venezuela. But the big one, this was the big knock to this whole thing. The European Central Bank basically gave a thumbs down on the theft of Russian assets in order to fund, as a source of funding for Europe. And that's a big one, because everybody in Europe was hoping that was their sort of, that was the leprechaun's chest of gold at the end of the rainbow there for von der Leyen and Merz and Macron. So now they're going, the only other option for funding this will be basically central banks have to print.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be, and that's austerity. That means inflation, austerity, the usual routine, and huge debt to GDP ratio, which is already not looking good in Europe. So,
why would they do that, Patrick? Why would they? I mean, if they didn't get the pot of gold there, the easy money, which surprises me a little. I thought that they might be able to irk that loose, but why would you go down a path that, I mean, any economic person can tell you is has almost no upside and significant potential downside? Why would they do that?
Just desperation. You know, if they can't underwrite this project any longer, I mean, I can't believe these people didn't like think about this in advance. So it's just not sustainable. But I think also, Daniel, the answer to that is, you know, much like with your debate recently with U.S. General Ben Hodges, is that there's a whole lot of people in this conversation that have been cheering for this proxy war from the beginning that are not living in reality. Mm-hmm. They really have believed that Russia is a spent force. It's on its last legs. They believe their propaganda lines, like Russia's only taken 1% more of Ukrainian territory. They have all these different statistical ways of framing the conflict, like Russia's basically not done anything. I even heard Mike Pompeo say it recently, like they've been in 4 years, Russia hasn't really moved at all in the Donbass, and you know, And then Putin's coming out and basically saying, we have been precise and surgical with our military operations. Our intent is not to level the country of Ukraine. I mean, he said this many times publicly, but this doesn't get addressed or acknowledged by any of these so-called war experts that are, you know, trying to drive and promote this proxy war for the last.
Well, as a matter of fact, we actually have that soundbite from what he said, because that also tails into what we also want to talk about next, which is that he's saying, listen, the Europe specifically, whether you're talking about that Italian general or the NATO general that said, we have to be more aggressive against Russia, whether you have the Germans saying we're going to expand our military, we're going to create conscription. The French says they have to be ready for war with Russia here by 2027, 2029. You pick the number here, all that stuff. Putin brought up that issue you just raised about the war.
I've said that 100 times. We have no plans of fighting against Europe. But if Europe wants to fight and they start this fight, then we are ready right now. There is no doubt about this. But the only question is, if Europe starts the war, unleashes this war, because that's not Ukraine. With Ukraine, we use some surgical means. We are trying to be really careful, because you understand why. This is not a war in the direct sense of the word. And Europe, all of a sudden, wants to start a war. And if it does start a war, then very rapidly there might be a situation where we have no one to negotiate with.
Yeah, so there again, you see that it seems to me, and you tell me if you agree or disagree, that Russia has done a calculation on the balance of forces between the two sides. And I don't mean Ukraine and Russia. I mean Ukraine and the West and Russia, and has calculated we're in pretty good shape there and they're not. So he can be a pretty cocky with his comments. What do you think?
Yeah, the first thing that Russia has done is probably have a bank of targets for missile locations in Europe, air bases, arms depots, and military defense manufacturing sites as well in Europe. So if this does come to blows, those will be the first targets. right there. And that's just academic. Now, the West might, NATO might do the same thing with Russia, but at that point, we're potentially into thermonuclear war at that point. I think what Putin's doing is trying to communicate the seriousness of these threats that are being made from Europe and completely unhinged. But here's the thing. You talked earlier about the European fissures between Washington and Europe, okay? This is really important. This is actually the changed factor when you look at Biden to Trump on this. If there was total solidarity between the U.S. and Europe, as there was under the Biden administration and NATO, you know, the U.S. could repackage some lend-lease. They could just keep this thing going forever. But the Trump administration, for better or for worse, has decided to create this ideological or political rift between the Europeans and Washington. And J.D. Vance's speech at the Munich Security Conference berating the Europeans for, you know, clamping down on free speech and so forth. And then Trump berating Zelensky, you know, all these sacred cows, you know, in terms of transatlantic solidarity have been slaughtered in the last 10 months. So, you know, whether that's, you know, a battle of ego brinksmanship with the Trump administration wanting to stamp its, you know, ideological or whatever authority over the global conversation in terms of the power relationships between the U.S. and Europe, that's one thing, but it's still happening. And this is actually the changed factor. This has created a new dynamic. Russia knows this. The irony, Daniel, of this, the irony is the destabilization of Ukraine, which was undertaken by U.S. intelligence from the moment the Iron Curtain fell. And even before that, by the way, this has been a long-running project in terms of OSS, CIA, Operation Aerodynamic, right from the late 1940s. But it really activated after the Cold War ended. And then it culminated in the Maidan, the U.S.-backed coup in 2014. And that set forth a series of events that is ultimately irreversible, which ends up in the breakup of Ukraine. It's a U.S.-driven project, the destabilization of Ukraine. And the irony is the U.S. want to back off it and exit this at right now, and Europe is stuck with a U.S. project, which ultimately. And the irony of this is just incredible.
Well, you know, a piece of that irony, I mentioned a second ago that Putin has done the balance of forces calculation and says, yeah, I can make these claims because I can back it up. That doesn't seem to be happening on the West side. And we still seem to be stuck in what you're describing as this idea and this aspiration that we may have had in the decades, even before 2022. And I guess just overnight, Macron was, caught on a hot mic or something and warning. It was reported in Der Spiegel this morning that the U.S. could betray Ukraine with these negotiations right now. And they are terrified that Trump may do, as you said the second ago, just walk away deal if you guys don't come up to some kind of a situation here. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's he can't totally walk away from this. That's the problem with the U.S. And this is why the Trump, Trump has to be, people have to be very careful. They can threaten to walk away from this and say, oh, it's not our problem. It's Europe's problem. But they're ultimately still going to have to supply funding and support weapons, either for sale or, you know, lend lease or for charity or whatever. They're still going to have to be involved in this one way or another. They can't completely divorce themselves. The other thing they can't is because Britain and some of these other European countries, they're well into, look at what happened this week. Tankers got attacked in the Black Sea. Where did that come from? That wasn't just from Ukraine acting on its own volition, more likely working with the British, who have been masterminding all of these underwater or marine drone attacks in the Black Sea out of Odessa and probably Romania as well. The French might very well be involved. So that was a provocation to escalate. If anything, this attack has given Russia the green light to move on Odessa more aggressively. And so look at every turn. If you think the lesson Moscow has learned from the West, right from the beginning of this conflict, is that when there's some major development in negotiations and Russia backs off or Russia pauses, it's met with escalation by the Ukrainians, backed by these NATO member states who are behind the scenes, helping them materially or providing ISR or whatever. It's happened every single time. So what do you to make of this if you're Moscow, that these people are bent on escalation? And is it because they want to provoke Russia? Because it seems like the statements from Europe now are getting so desperate that they want to provoke Russia. A preemptive strike against Russia is to provoke a reaction. That's how I translate that. But they're in crazy land there, because they did, you know, where's that going to end? Certainly it's not going to be good for Europe. So, but look at this, the attacking Russia's so-called shadow fleet, they're calling it. This is just begging for, an acceleration of whatever ground efforts Russia are planning around Kherson, Zaporizhia, and ultimately Nikolaev and Odessa.
Well, you talk about some of the comments coming out of Europe. I mean, Ursula von der Leyen yesterday was talking about where they want to go, and they periodically, I think in this soundbite you're going to hear, they're going to eventually use some term about peace and negotiations or something like that. But look at the context with which your comment here is, because it's all about more military.
As from the beginning, Ukraine can rely on the fact that Europe will remain the strongest and most steadfast partner. We all know that we can never match the sacrifice of the Ukrainian people, but what we can match is their stamina, their resolve, their staying power, and we can equip them with the means to defend themselves and to lead peace negotiations from a position of strength. And since pressure is the only language the Kremlin responds to, we can also dial it up. We have to increase the costs of war for Putin's aggression, and today's proposal gives us the means to do this.
You know, I guess what really annoys me, I got to say, and there's no kinder way to put it, is that there's no logic put behind the claim here by Ursula von der Leyen. And of course, this is a common theme that's out, is that the only language Russia understands is force. And so we're going to give the Ukraine side, from a position of strength, an ability to have a negotiation that's going to work to their favor. Yet there is no roadmap of how you even imagine that you're going to get from where you are now, which is this on the imbalance, to something else where the balance is in the other direction. There's not even the theory about behind what it is. And yet they just keep throwing, here, we'll throw out some more cash, and then that's where we're headed. But there's no roadmap. What do you make of it?
Yeah, it's back to the basic game dynamics, is that Ukraine's obviously losing, and then they're demanding, you know, that Russia, you know, give concessions, or that Russia pays reparations. I mean, they're still talking about reparations in Brussels, like this is some scenario that's going to come where Russia's going to lose. And that's also, you know, that's another bowling pin that's been knocked down this week by the ECB. And with regards to, you know, the Euroclear issue, as well as, you know, being able to steal the interest off of the funds, the Russian frozen assets, and use the interest on those funds in order to, pay the Ukrainians or whatever. And Russia's already written off the frozen assets. And so if it's not even a factor for leverage right now, it doesn't matter for them. It, you know, if they get it back, great. But, you know, if they got it back and then they had to pay reparations, that pretty much cancels that out anyway. So, but the reason that's important, because that's the engine that, you know, there has to be money behind these proclamations by the European Union and NATO, and there's no money there. And so that's like, so where's the funds going to come from? Nowhere. So what is this? I think it's just total political bluster, talking to, I think, a brain dead media that are also complicit in this whole charade, is the European media, as well as all of the European politicians, everyone waving their Ukraine flags for the first couple of years. And you can notice they're not, there's no Ukraine flags on their European Parliament, a flag holder thing by their seat in the parliament anymore. It's not happening. everyone's looking for a way to sort of get off this. But here's the thing, Danny, you know, Washington can wash their hands of this, still profit from it, because now they have almost a monopoly on LNG going into Europe, you know, US and some of the, you know, Qatar as well. So but Europe's going to have to wear this. They're going to have to wear the shame and the failure and the humiliation. There's no way around it now. I think there's a ball has been set in motion. Even if this takes, you know, a year to resolve, or 2 years to resolve, or whatever, that this is, to me, it's just such a catastrophic defeat for NATO and for Europe politically. Because NATO is a political organization now. It's not a military alliance. It ceased being a military alliance years ago.
It's ironic. You mentioned that about the LNG and about how, because of all these sanctions we put on Russia and weaning us off from the oil and stuff like that, it is now saddled Europe with a much higher amount of oil, or a much higher cost to per unit to actually fund their economic, and that's had predictable negative impact on their economy, et cetera. Ironically, even though that's good for the United States and our business, Ursula von der Leyen also tried to put a good face on this and actually brag about that.
Yeah.
This is the dawn of a new era, the era of Europe's full energy independence from Russia. Many believe this would be impossible. Well, the figures speak for themselves, and let me give you some. Today, Russian gas imports, so LNG and pipeline, are down from 45% at the beginning of the war to 13%. Coal imports are down from 51% at the beginning of the war to now 0%. And crude oil imports are down from 26% to 2% today. I always knew that we could deliver with unity, with resolve, and by building on the extraordinary work of the past 3 years.
You know, she bragged about energy independence from Moscow, kind of forgot to mention the energy dependence now on the much more expensive American LNG. What does that mean?
You know, and it's so funny that she said by 2027, we're going to finally achieve full independence from Russian fuel. This conflict, this war is going to be over by 2017, if it's not already over. It's going to be told, the fat lady is going to be singing a second round of the chorus in 2027. So what's she talking about? She will not be in Brussels in 2027. She'll be gone. She might be in jail for all we know if the current corruption noose Titans in Brussels. It's only beginning now, the corruption investigations in Brussels against the EU and the Diplomatic Academy. Federica Mogherini, she was the former Kalia Kallas's predecessor there, the high representative for foreign policy for the EU. So what's von der Leyen talking about? And it gets back to the original argument, Daniel. The original argument is that we can't, and this was what the Americans imposed on Europe, the Biden administration. They said, you cannot allow the Russians to weaponize energy against our European friends. That was the Biden party line. Russia never weaponized or politicized the energy. Look at what the United States have done. They've completely politicized and weaponized energy. Nord Stream pipeline, first exhibit, okay? But put that even off to the side, as outrageous and bombastic of a caper that was. So whoever you think did it, I believe that this is a NATO operation. The Ukrainian thing to me is a red herring, but put that aside. You can argue about that. The point is the US are using that as political leverage, as economic leverage to shape European politics and foreign policy. So they're doing exactly the thing that they accused Russia, which Russia never did to Europe. The United States is doing to Europe with energy. Not only that, they're bankrupting and deindustrializing countries like Germany in the process. This is beyond debate. This is not something that we can argue about. It's fact. Okay? It's fact. Prima facie. It is what it is. And the fact that this isn't part of the conversation yet, but I think it will be. There will be a backlash. If the populist right grows a brain in any of these European countries, and they seize on this issue, then we have hope that Europe could sort of rescue itself from this terminal death spiral that they've placed themselves in. Under the Biden administration put them into this death spiral. You know, if Trump was a really magnanimous and great statesman, he would go to the granular detail on this and say, you could lay it all at the feet of Joe Biden. Lay all of it. Lay Nord Stream. Biden said, with Olaf Scholz standing right next to him in the White House, we're going to destroy the Nord Stream pipeline. We're going to end it. He said, quote, end it. There's that. Biden promised not to send offensive missiles into Ukraine to Putin before the war began in December 2021. And Biden reneged on that agreement, and that created huge problems and escalation. That's actually one of the reasons for Russia's absolute insistence on realizing its security objectives. Because of that, Trump could, if he was into details, if he was more literate and had better advisors, he could really crucify Biden and really lay the war at his feet, not just saying it's Biden's war, but getting specific, because those specifics bear directly on the Russian positions today.
That's
how you solve this. That's how you get out of this Minotaur's maze that Trump is wandering around in, with Witkoff and Kushner in Moscow looking at the ceiling art in the Kremlin. It's great. I'm sure it was a wow. But, you know, they're not going to get much further than that unless they start getting smart. That takes serious, shrewd statecraft. You need Henry Kissinger with a big heart, you know, and some foresight. You know, you need Zbigniew Brzezinski without the globalism. You know, you need people that know what they're doing and they know where the targets are. And Trump doesn't have that. That's a big weakness, I see.
No, yeah, without question it is. That's across the board for the United States foreign policy and diplomatic prowess. It just doesn't exist anymore because we've just let it wither on the vine. I want to ask you real quick, what do you think? We talk a lot about Europe and the United States and Russia here. I haven't talked much about the Ukraine portion of that, but given that Zelensky's right-hand and left-hand man have either fled been forced to resign, with Yermak and Mindich, I think his name was, and now a lot of people looking from this NBU and other kinds of organs that, you know, how far does this go up into Zelensky's pockets himself? And might there be an issue with him with all that broiling at home? And now that the front line's starting to collapse here, and as Macron's warning about maybe the United is going to cut them loose, how do you see this playing out in Kiev? And what maneuver room does Zelensky have, if any at all?
That, you know, Yermak was regarded as Zelensky's brain. That was one of his many nicknames. Okay, so everything Zelensky did, every sort of, you know, speech that he read off of his phone when he does his social media things and his videos and his statements, is all done and scripted and cleared by Yermak's desk. Okay, so having lost that, and Zelensky was kept in an information bubble. Understand this as well. So he's not really given the bandwidth or the latitude to think about what maybe the true situation on the battlefield is, what are the true casualty numbers, and so forth. And he's really like an actor or a politician that's just pushed around, sent on planes, doing constant fundraising tours. Think about how much time your average U.S. senator or congressman spends raising money during their term and not actually doing the business of, you know, being a representative of their constituency. That's like Zelensky as president spends more time raising money, cash, weapons, and other welfare, international welfare, than he does actually being president of Ukraine. So he's a wartime president. His job specific. It's raise money, bring in the weapons, make the deals, press the flesh internationally, keep Ukraine up as a priority in the West. So that, having lost Yermak is massive. I didn't think I would see the day. But you know what? Yermak has a lot of insurance policies. Because Yermak, if you remember, there were tapes released of Biden and Poroshenko. You remember a couple of years ago? Those were known as the Derkash tapes, named after Andrei Derkash, who originally released these tapes. Now, these were originally let out of the president's office because Poroshenko recorded everything crazy. He recorded everything, and he left everything when he left office, and Yermak basically hoovered it all up. And in there was, guess what? It was compromise against Biden. Okay, so this was all public in Ukraine, but it was really hushed down in the U.S. media during the Biden administration and during Trump's first term. And that had to do with Burisma, kickbacks, all sorts of things between Poroshenko and Biden. Yermak has all of that. So there's a lot of insurance there that'd be hugely embarrassing.
He knows where the bodies are buried. That's
he
kind
does,
of the bottom
yes.
line.
And Yermak is a very clever political operator that built a very tight network of control during his time in office and was really micromanaging so many different things. Now that Zelensky is he's probably having to process things himself for the first time without the filter. And now so this might even change Zelensky's outlook on the current situation, and you might see, I think it's a little too much, too little, too late for Zelensky of having an epiphany on some really important points. I think we saw clues of that when this corruption scandal broke initially, the Mindich end of it, which is going to continue to cascade. And you saw Zelensky made that kind of a little bit of a amorphous statement there about, you know, this is a time when we need to make big decisions for the country's history and da da da. Wasn't sure. No one was clear what he meant with that initial statement. Yeah. So, but it was different than the resolute party line that he had always laid with this messaging previously. So that's interesting. So what you need to understand is Zelensky has been stage managed. Mainly by, it's my understanding anyway, and probably Scott Ritter would agree and others, that the British were kind of managing Zelensky in terms of public relations, communications, imagery, maybe even his itinerary to some degree, and his close security protection. So Britain will likely try to use this political chaos right now in Kiev because they have the bridesmaid waiting. In London, his name is Valery Zaluzhny. Now, this might have worked on paper before, but this is a very, if they think they're going to parachute Zaluzhny in, which I can only see this done through a military coup or through an election. That election's not going to happen anytime soon. This could all fall apart very quickly for Zelensky. But Zaluzhny coming in, he's supposed to have the trust of the military and be able to control the far right. The Ukrainian nationalist Nazi elements.
Yeah.
That might have worked on paper a year ago when you're kind of formulating this plan. This is a very different situation now. So I don't think it's going to work.
Yeah. And I'm not sure that Zaluzhny, I'm not sure anybody has control over the far right, the Nazi element inside of Ukraine in any case. But I guess we'll have to wait and see how that unfolds. Before I let you go today, though, I wonder, you mentioned earlier in the show, and I want to circle back on that and kind of get your views right now on the situation in Venezuela, because we have the potential for something to really explode. And now, obviously, right now, everybody's focused on this issue with Hegseth and his ordering of these this double tap, so-called, or as I did on a show earlier today, the fact that we're doing it at all violates all kinds of international and American laws. But let's for the moment here focus on what could come next, aside from the Hegseth issue here. And that is that, according to reports, Trump had a phone call with Maduro here a few days back and gave him basically a weak ultimatum. It says, you either leave on your own or we're going to make it leave for you. And then you see that Maduro there is basically just kind of in your face. He was out dancing in public and saying, we're going to stay here. So really, he's kind of called Trump's bluff because apparently he's not going to do that. So now with all this combat power in the region and Trump's bluff been called, do you think that it's going to end up embarrassing for us like it did in 2018 when we tried to have a coup there in the first place and it didn't work and we just kind of walked away from it? Or do you think that Trump this time is going to pull the string on the military part?
This is it's really interesting. So the reports, I believe Trump probably had a phone call and probably gave him an ultimatum. And I am sure that Nicolas Maduro said no. But what did come out after that is I think a lot of fake stories were planted in the U.S. media that Maduro said he would leave in 18 months, needs a little more time, or that this was some legitimate offer that he could be extradited or given free passage to Qatar, of all places, which is just insane and ridiculous. But I think these have all been floated out in the U.S. media to try to create the consensus or the impression that Maduro is trying to looking for a way out, as it were. And Daniel McAdams and Ron Paul were talking about this very issue on the Liberty Report this week. And I think they're absolutely correct. I think this was part of a public relations effort by the Trump administration, by the CIA, and their agents of influence within the U.S. media, of which there are many. They're floating up some crazy stories that that Venezuela rigged the 2008 presidential election in the U.S., putting Obama in, Smartmatic. They're bringing out the Sidney Powell stuff again.
I didn't know he had that much power. That's pretty impressive.
It's all coming. It's like Mike Lindell TV's pushing out all this. Patrick Byrne saying that the CIA is on the CIA is on the Cuban payroll. Like, our CIA is on the Cuban payroll. What kind of payroll can Cuba afford?
I've been to Cuba. I can assure you, they can't even afford butter. So I'm pretty sure that they can't, buy our CIA.
So they're flooding the U.S. media zone with all this garbage, this crazy stuff. To get buy-in on the MAGA Republican side, at least with Trump supporters. But the thing is, and what you mentioned is important, Daniel, at the beginning, the Hegseth issue could. It's so funny that this little seemingly small event in September could totally undermine this undeclared illegal war of aggression against Venezuela, this issue of the war crime for Pete Hegseth. And I think he's dead. He doesn't have any defense at all. If it goes into any judicial process, whatever, he's already incriminated himself multiple times over. And not only that, but the fact that the U.S. changed its policy right after that, and also changed command. And then you remember when the U.S. hit the so-called narco trafficking submarine off the. In the Pacific, they rescued the two or the people that survived. So clearly there was a policy change that was directly a reaction to what Hegseth and they had done with that boat previously. And this is all just finally coming out in the wash. So Trump lied about it. Hegseth lied about it. And they think they could, and look, if Hegseth gets done or impeached or fired or resigns or whatever, or convicted, Trump's just going to pardon him. And he's going to pardon the SEAL Team 6 Admiral as well. He's going to get the pardon. They're all going to get pardoned. But I think this is really a knock on the war effort against Venezuela, because there's no factual basis. There's no evidence that's been presented, about the actual narco traffickers, about what the cargo of the boat was. Nothing. We have nothing. It's more threadbare than Iraqi WMDs, because at least the Bush administration had the decency to put on a show for us. They respected us enough to go through the whole Winnebagoes of Death and Colin Powell at the UN. I mean, it was entertaining. We still have the photos. We still have the photos for that. It's provided decades of entertainment for us. But Trump doesn't even have the decency to fake it. They just make stuff up on the fly and just say, just put Stephen Miller on and say, narco-terrorists, they all got to die. You know, they don't even bother faking the intelligence. Remember Niger uranium yellow cake?
Yeah, yellow cake.
I mean, this was brilliant. I mean, I hate to say this, Daniel, I don't want this to sound completely off, but you almost got to respect the Bush administration for putting in the effort.
Almost. Yeah.
I mean, that's the way I'm seeing this. It's just incredible. So, but you can't, and it's a war in our hemisphere. It's an undeclared war of aggression. It's an illegal war of aggression. What they've done already is completely against all maritime law, international law, U.S. law.
Right.
Hegseth is falling foul of U.S. military code, Geneva Conventions, etc. So if this is the way Trump is going to prosecute what's clearly a war for oil, and his surrogates are saying this openly. They're saying this openly, that we need to get hold of these oil assets. The CIA's plant, Maria Corina Machado, she is I'm saying that as my opinion, but I'm not alone. But I think she's a CIA plant. She's USAID funded, her organization. So she's saying that, oh, there's trillions of dollars in Venezuelan energy assets that we need to, you know, open up for the West. You know, they're talking, it's a hostile takeover. The U.S. has already taken Citgo during Trump's first term. They seized the assets, and during Biden, they seized the assets of the Venezuelan state oil company. They seized their embassy in Washington, and they divvied out some of the proceeds. They sold some of it or parlayed some of the cash to Juan Guaido, the U.S. appointed president of Venezuela. So the record from the U.S. is already really bad. The only thing is we have such, I think the population is just so beleaguered with war and propaganda in the first 10 months of the Trump administration that they're almost willing to, some people are almost willing to submit to this narrative because it's in their hemisphere. They can get a win. And I think the last time on this program, I sort of was trying to make a comparison to this and the Falklands War during Margaret Thatcher. And politically, there are some similarities with Thatcher's economy was really struggling at home, just like Trump's economy is really struggling, despite the great, you know, declarations of the golden era and all the tariff wars and all of this stuff. But what it did was it really signaled, while they got a Pyrrhic victory, the British did in the Falklands, it signaled the end of their ability to act outside of their own region. And it was just the end of an era, basically. And this is what Venezuela looks like it's shaping up to be if they push the military button on this. I can't see how it's going to end well for the United States by any angle at all. At least with, you know, in terms of its relations with other Latin American countries, it's going to turbocharge socialist and left-wing anti-imperialist movements throughout Latin America. It's going to help those governments get into power. It's going to create a lot of suspicion with the CIA and U.S. companies and so forth. And so if they're going to go down this road, they could lose Brazil. They've already lost Colombia and a whole bunch of other countries.
Let me ask you a question, because you said a while ago that unlike the Bush administration, they at least didn't put on a show. Well, they have attempted one. You kind of alluded to it a little bit there with Stephen Miller and some others who have been making the argument, Hegseth being one of them, that, you know what? This is legal because we have designated them narco-terrorists. Mm-hmm. And as Dan Crenshaw said on a soundbite that I actually showed on a show earlier today, he's like saying, man, when I was a special forces guy, we didn't like ask if anybody got wounded when we killed these guys because they're terrorists. And Al-Qaeda and ISIS, Hegseth specifically made that direct connection. What do you make of that in terms of the legality? Does that make people go, oh, okay, well, that's cool then. As long as they're those kind of guys, we can go after them.
For the warmongering crowd, this is the same excuse all these people used to justify the mass slaughter of Palestinians for the last two years in Gaza. Exactly the same. They're either terrorists or they're terrorists in waiting, or they're going to grow up to be terrorists. They use this term terrorism kind of has to be consigned to the dustbin of history pretty soon, because it's destroying countries, it's destroying institutions, it's causing wars, and it's allowing for a level of unbridled corruption. It's destroying our international legal framework, our domestic legal framework. Terrorism, what is it? It's a part of the psyop from Trump is Stephen Miller and all the rest of them, and Marco Rubio just said that Hezbollah is using Venezuela as a launching. Are you kidding me? Are you serious? Hezbollah active in South America? They've been trying this in right-wing circles, Duncan Hunter being one of the most infamous on this. But a lot of people have been, Michael Flynn and everybody else have been trafficking in this nonsense for years. And here they are. They're regurgitating it again. Like Hezbollah and Hamas are somehow working through Venezuela, and they're working their way up to the southern border of the U.S. It's just total balderdash. I mean, but they're using that, Daniel, to buttress the idea or the concept of the narco terrorist, because there is no terrorism with the narco or whatever. It's crime. We've been fighting the war on drugs since the Reagan administration, and it's been an abject failure. And now they've just added an adjunct to that concept, which is terrorism, in order to give it some legal justification, because this term is absolutely made a mockery of our entire, you know, jurisprudence and law enforcement system. And we all know that historically, and it's not my opinion, it's documented, some of the biggest drug traffickers in the Western Hemisphere, the CIA and the DEA, working in concert with certain cartel members, one of which Trump just pardoned.
Yeah.
The former president of Honduras that was thrown in the clink in a U.S. federal trial. And Trump says, oh, well, you know, people I know, guys I play golf with, said he was very, very mistreated. No, Rubio is probably coming from Rubio to spring this guy. I mean, I don't even want to think about where the order really came from. Did the order come from the cartels through someone in the U.S. government to spring this guy? I mean, that's what you got to think about. The level of corruption that this is on display here with the Trump administration is quite shocking. I thought the Biden administration was bad, and Nancy Pelosi and all the open border policies and all this stuff. But this is next level right now. And if we don't see some serious pushback, either from the press or somebody else in, you know, across the aisle in Washington, this is a bad precedent. Somebody who's trafficking 400 tons of cocaine into the U.S. So how can the president be declaring a war on drugs to the point where he's willing to invade another country based on zero evidence while he is basically pardoning at the same time in order to rig or to interfere in the current Honduran elections? So the thing that they crucified Trump for in 2016 was that he was a product of Russian or foreign interference in the U.S. electoral system. They hung that noose around his neck for 10 years, okay? And what is he doing? He is interfering in the Argentinian elections using economic blackmail and leverage. He's now interfering directly in the Honduran elections. So it's sad because, you know, President Trump could have taken this a totally different direction based on his experience and how he has suffered politically. And instead, the swamp has molded him into the ultimate swamp creature.
Wow.
He has become a swamp reptile of the highest order. And it's very sad because it didn't have to happen this way. At least we live in hope that there was a chance that it might not. But this is worse than anything we've seen from even any neocon administration.
I know, Patrick. And look, this is almost 1 year into four. So, yeah, let that sink in for a bit. But anyway, this show won't last another 4 years, but we'll keep talking about this. But thank you so much for coming on today and providing such clarity on really both of these issues here. And maybe the next time you're on, we'll go down a little bit further down this situation. Hopefully we won't be at war with Venezuela by the time you come back on next, but that's something that we'll keep a close eye on. So thank you so much for that. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks, Danny.
And also as a reminder there, you can see Patrick Henningsen on his Substack, and of course on the Sunday Wire. Be sure and watch that. He's at 21 Wire, I believe it is. That's your handle there. Recommend people go and check that stuff out in between that. And we will be back with you this afternoon with Matthew Ho, former State Department official, on several issues here that you're not going to want to meet. I think that's Gary, what time? That's a 1 p.m. if I'm not mistaken, right?
2 o'clock, Danny.
2 p.m. Sorry, 2 p.m. Yeah, we'll be back with you with Matt Ho, always one of our faves. We'll see you at 2 o'clock on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.